Chapter 9. Darius, Summer 530 A.D. The first day after her return to Darius, Antoninus spent with her son. Phocius was ecstatic to see his mother after a separation of several months, the more so when he saw the small mountain of gifts which she had brought back for him from fabled Constantinople. Yet for all that the boy kept one eager, impatient eye upon his fascinating new toys, he spent the first day cuddling with his mother. The seven-year-old's delight in the reunion was the product of simple joy, not relief. He had obviously been well treated during her absence. Indeed, suspected Antoninus, hefting his weight, he had been spoiled outright. By the second day, of course, the imperative demand of new toys overwhelmed all filial devotion. At the crack of dawn, Phocius was at his play. When his mother appeared an hour or so later, the boy gave her no more than perfunctory words of greeting. Mothers, after all is said and done, are mothers. As cherishable as the sunrise, to be sure, but equally certain. Toys now. Who knows when they might vanish into whatever magic realm brought them forth. Antonina watched him at his play for a bit. On another occasion there might have been a touch of rueful regret in her son's preoccupation, but Antonina, in truth, was impatient to get on with her own pressing tasks. So it was not long before she headed off to the workshop where John of Rhodes awaited her. The workshop, she saw at a glance, had been considerably expanded during the months of her absence, and as she drew nearer, she realized that John was no longer working alone. Through the open door of the workshop, she could hear the sound of voices. At first, the realization disconcerted her. She was swept with uneasiness. The past weeks in Constantinople had left her with a heightened sense of secrecy and security. Within seconds, however, uneasiness was pushed aside by another emotion. There could be only one reason that John had brought other men into his work. So it was hope, not anxiety, which quickened her last steps into the workshop. What she encountered entering melded both sentiments in an instant. A loud crashing noise caused her to flinch. Fortunately. The flinch gave her the momentum to duck. Fortunately. The unknown missile whizzing by missed her head by a comfortable margin. Unlike the ricochet, which struck her squarely on the rump. The ricochet had little force behind it, however. It was surprise more than pain which tumbled her squawking to the floor. "In the name of Christ, Antonina," bellowed John of Rhodes. "Can't you read a simple sign?" The naval officer arose from behind an upended table and stalked toward her. It was obvious from its neat and tidy placement that the table had been upended deliberately. John reached down a hand and hauled Antonina to her feet. Then, not relinquishing his grip on her wrist, he dragged her back through the doorway she had just entered. Outside, he spun her around. "Right there," he roared, "where everyone can see it." He pointed triumphantly above the door. "In plain and simple Greek, it says—" Silence. Antonina rubbed her rump, scowling. "Yes, John? It says what?" Silence. Then, "Eusebius, come here." A moment later, an apprehensive young man appeared in the doorway. He was short, thick, swarthy, rather evil-looking, in fact. Not at all the image of the innocent cherub he was desperately trying to project. John pointed accusingly at the empty space above him. "Where's the sign I told you to hang there?" he demanded. Eusebius looked sheepish. "Forgot," he mumbled. John took a deep breath, blew it out, and began stumping about in the courtyard. His hands were firmly planted on his hips, arms akimbo. Antonina knew the signs. She was in no mood for one of the naval officer's tirades. "Never mind, John," she exclaimed. "There's no harm done, other than to my dignity."
"That's not the point," snarled John. "This stuff is dangerous enough without some fool boy forgetting again to take simple precautions like hanging—"
"What dangerous stuff?" demanded Antonina, smiling brightly. "Oh, that sounds exciting." John broke off his stumping. He waved his arms. "We've got it, Antonina," he cried excitedly. "We've got it! Gunpowder! Come on, I'll show you." He charged back inside. Eusebius, moving out of the wave, gave Antonina a thankful glance. For the second time, Antonina entered the workshop. Bang, whiz, thump, clatter, clatter, clatter. She scrambled back outside, ducking. Behind her, John's bellow.
Eusebius, you idiot! Didn't I tell you to put out the slow match?
Forgot, came the mutter. Outside of having the memory of an olive, he's really been a great help, said John later. He took a thoughtful sip of wine. Chemistry isn't really my strong point. Eusebius has a knack for it like nobody I've ever seen.
Better hire someone to keep track of what he's supposed to remember, then, said Antoninus, smiling.
John set his cup down on the table firmly, planted his hands on the table firmly, squared his shoulders firmly.
We can't afford it, Antonina, he said, firmly.
There's no point dancing about the matter. Scowl. Procopius has been rubbing his hands with glee for a week now, ever since he got here ahead of you and went over the books. Fierce scowl. He can't wait to tell you, this swine.
I've gone through the money. All of it. Not a solidus left, not one.
Very fierce scowl.
And Sittus, fat cheapskate, won't cough up anything more. He denounced me for a spendthrift the last time I asked.
Antoninus' smile didn't fade. How many times have you hit him up?
Sullenly. 8. Well, 7, successfully.
Congratulations, she laughed. That's a record. No one else has ever squeezed money out of him more than twice in a row, so far as I know.
John's smile was very thin. It's not really a joke, Antonina. We can't go any further without money, and I don't know where it's going to come from. I can't get anything from Cassian, either. The bishop's got his own problems. Patriarch Ephraim's been on a rampage lately, howling about church funds being misspent. His deacons have been crawling all over Anthony like fleas on a dog. They even counted his personal silverware.
What's the matter? Sneered Antonina. Are Ephraim's silk robes wearing out?
There was a bit more humor in John's smile now. Just a bit. Not that I've noticed. Not to keep track, of course, all the robes he's got. No, I think maybe he's peeved because he doesn't have as many pounds of gold on the rings of his left hand as he does on the right. Makes him list when he promenades through the streets of Antioch, blessing the poor.
The naval officer snorted, sighed. He cast a glance around the room. They were sitting in the main salon of the villa, at a table in the corner.
I'd suggest selling one of your marvelous tapestries, he muttered. Except
we don't have any.
Precisely.
Antonina's smile turned into a very cheerful grin. She shook her head. I should stop teasing you. I'm ashamed of myself. The fact is, my dear John, that money is no longer a problem. I have acquired a new financial backer for our project. She reached down and hauled up a sack. Hauled. The table clumped when she set it down. John's eyes widened. Antonina, still grinning, seized the bottom of the sack and upended it. A small torrent of gold coins spilled across the table.
Freshly minted, I hope you notice, she said gaily.
John ogled the pile. It wasn't the coins themselves which held his gaze, however. It was his knowledge of what lay behind them. Power. Raw power. Since the reign of the emperors Valentinian and Valens, gold coin, the solidus inaugurated by Constantine the Great, which had been Rome's stable currency for 2 centuries, were minted very exclusively. There were many legal mints in the Roman Empire, big ones in Thessalonica and Nicomedia, and a number of small ones in other cities, but they were restricted to issuing silver and copper coinage. By law, only the emperor minted gold coin. In Constantinople, at the great palace itself.
You told Theodora, he stated.
Antonina nodded.
Was that wise? He asked.
There was no accusation in the question, simply curiosity. Antonina shrugged. I think so. Under the circumstances, I didn't have much choice. I became deeply embroiled in imperial intrigue while I was in Constantinople. The reason Irene didn't come back with me is because she's now, in fact, if not in theory, Theodora's spymaster. John eyed her with deep interest.
Malwa?
Yes, they're developing some kind of treacherous plot, John. So far all we know is...
She broke off.
Never mind. It's a long tale, and I don't want to have to tell it twice in the same day. Anthony, Michael, and Sittis will be coming for dinner tonight. Morris and Hermogenes will be there, too. They're also both involved now. I'll explain everything then.
She reached out a hand and began scooping the coins back into the sack.
Anyway, I think telling Theodora was necessary, and the right thing to do, for that matter. We'll know soon enough. She'll be coming here later this summer, for a full tour of the project.
What?
Cried John.
This summer?
He leapt to his feet, waved his arms angrily.
Impossible! Impossible! I won't have anything ready by then! Impossible!
He began stumping back and forth furiously.
Crazed women! No sense of reality! None at all! Impossible! The gunpowder's still too unpredictable! The grenades are untested! Rockets aren't even that!
Stump, stump, stump.
Lunatic females. Think chemistry is like baking bread. There's something wrong with the way the powder burns. I know there is. Need to experiment with different ways of mixing the stuff.
Stump, stump, stump.
Idiot girls. Maybe grind it if I can figure out a way how to do it without blowing myself up. Maybe wet it first. That's an idea. What the hell can't hurt?
Stump, stump, stump.
Hell, it can't. That moron Eusebius could blow up anything. Blow up a frigging pile of cow dung, you don't watch him, careless as a woman.
Stump, stump, stump. The early hours of the evening, before and during the meal, were primarily devoted to Procopius. It wasn't difficult. For months of practice, Antonina had developed the craft of Procopius baiting to a fine art. In truth, her expertise was largely wasted. By now, Procopius was so well-trained that literally anything would serve the purpose. Like a yoked and blinkered mule pulling a capstan, he could see nothing before him but the well-trod path. Antonina had but to remark on a fine horse. Procopius would scribble on the infamy of bestialism. Chat with a peasant housewife. A treatise on the ancient sin of Sappho was the sure result. Place her son in her lap? Ah, splendid. Procopius would burn his lamp through the night, producing a veritable treatise on pedophilia and incest. So her sultry glances at the men about the table, her veiled remarks, her giddy laughter, her sly innuendos, even the joke about four soldiers and a pair of holy men being more than any woman could handle at one sitting, giggle, giggle, were a complete waste of effort. She could have been alone at the table in the cold light of dawn, eating her meal in silence. By mid-morning, Procopius would be assuring anyone who listened that the harlot masturbated at breakfast. Soon enough, Procopius left the table and retired to his chamber. There was no need for Antonina to send him away on some pretext. The man was fairly bursting with anxiety to reach his quill.
God, I am sick of that man, snarled Sittis.
For a moment, the general looked like he was going to spit out his wine. But only for a moment. He reconsidered, swallowed, poured himself a new goblet.
Is this absolutely necessary? Growled Michael of Macedonia.
Antonina made a face. But before she could reply, Bishop Cassian spoke, harshly.
Yes, Michael, it is. That foul creature, though he's too stupid to know it, is Malwa's chief spy on Antonina. He's the aqueduct which brings them the water of knowledge. Except that Antonina has seen to it that the aqueduct is actually a sewer, piping nothing but filth into their reservoirs. He smiled. It was quite a wicked smile, actually, for a bishop. Almost devilish. They're not having a meeting here, plotting against Malwa. We're having an orgy. Then, with a sly smile, is it your reputation which frets you so? The Macedonian glared.
All reputation is folly, he pronounced. Folly!
Fed by pride, which is worse still, concluded the bishop. His smile widened. Really, Michael, you must develop a broader repertoire of proverbs. Antonina cleared her throat.
As I was saying.
You weren't saying anything, Antonina, pointed out Cassian reasonably. So I saw no reason not to idle away the time by a harmless...
Stop picking on Michael, grumbled Morris. He's done wonders with the local lads and their wives and parents. Even the village elders aren't howling louder than a medium-sized storm at sea.
Well, of course he has, exclaimed Cassian cheerfully. He's a holy man, must be good for something.
Antonina headed off the gathering storm.
Tell me, Michael, she said forcefully, what is your assessment?
Michael? The Macedonian broke off his quite futile attempt to glower down the bishop.
Excuse me, Antonina, I didn't catch that.
The peasants, she stated.
What is your assessment?
Michael waved his hand. It wasn't an airy gesture, rather the opposite. So might a stone punctuate solidity.
There will be no problem. None.
More than that, added Morris, a good number of them, I think, would jump at the chance to join a new regiment.
He eyed John of Rhodes, assuming there's something for them to do besides drive sheep at the enemy. John didn't rise to the bait.
Stop worrying, Morris. You get your new regiment put together. I'll have weapons for them. Grenades at the very least.
No rockets? Asked Hermogenes.
John winced.
Wouldn't count on it. The damn things are trickier to make than I thought. He drained his cup, poured himself another. Then, grumbling, the problem actually isn't making them. I've got a good 20 rockets piled up in the workshed. Every one of them will fly, too, and blow up quite spectacularly. The problem is that there's no telling where.
Another wince.
I had one rocket, and this is the bare truth. The damn thing actually flew in a circle and almost took our heads off.
How do the Malwa aim them? Asked Sittis.
There must be a way.
John shrugged.
I don't know. I've tried everything I can think of. Fire them through tubes, put vanes on them, even feathers. Nothing works. Some go more or less straight, most don't. And I can't for the life of me figure out any rhyme or reason behind it.
Morris slapped the table with the flat of his hand.
So let's not worry about it, he urged. When the general gets back from India...
If, murmured John.
When he gets back, drove on Morris, I'm sure he'll be able to tell us the secret of aiming rockets. In the meantime, let's stick to grenades. Those will be more than enough to keep a new regiment of peasant recruits busy.
Morris has an idea, announced Sittis.
The general beamed.
Marvelous idea, I think. And you know me, I generally look on new ideas about the same way I look on cow dung.
What is it? Asked Antonina. Morris rubbed his scalp. The gesture was one of his few affectations. The hair on that scalp was iron gray, but it was as still as full as it had been when he was a boy.
I got to thinking. The problem with grenades is that you want to be able to heave them a fair distance before they blow up. Then you face a trade-off between distance and effectiveness. The man with a good arm can toss a grenade fairly far, but only if it's so small it doesn't do much good when it lands. If he tries to throw a big grenade, he has to get well within bow range to do it.
The veteran shrugged.
Under most battle conditions, my cataphracts would turn him into a pincushion before he got off more than one. I have to assume that the enemy could do as well. Persians could, for sure.
So what's your solution? Asked John.
Scorpions?
Morris shook his head.
No, mind you, I'm all for developing grenade artillery. Wouldn't be hard at all to adapt a stone-throwing scorpion for that purpose. But that's artillery, fine in its place, but it's no substitute for infantry.
Hermogenes smiled. He was one of the few modern Roman generals who specialized in infantry warfare. Belisarius himself had groomed the young officer and urged him in that direction.
More cavalry, grumbled Sittis.
This general, on the other hand, was passionately devoted to the cataphract traditions.
Forget cavalry, said Morris. These lands are peasants pure and simple, Sittis. Syrian peasants to boot. Thracian and Illyrian peasants have some familiarity with horses, but these boys have none at all. You know as well as I do, they'd never make decent horsemen. Not in the time we've got.
Sittis nodded, quite magnanimously. The honor of the cavalry having been sustained, he would not argue the point further.
And that's the key, stated Morris. I tried to figure out the best way to combine Syrian peasants and grenades, starting with the strengths and limitations of both. The answer was obvious.
Silence.
John exploded.
Well, out with it, then!
Slings. And sling staffs.
John frowned.
Slings?
He started to argue, more out of ingrained habit than anything else, but fell silent.
Hmm.
He quaffed his wine. Antonina grinned. What's the matter, John? Don't tell me you haven't got an instant opinion.
The naval officer grimaced.
Alas, no. Truth is, much as I hate to admit it, I don't know anything about slings. Never used the silly things in naval combat.
You wouldn't call them silly things if you'd ever faced Balearic slingers on a battlefield, growled Morris.
Hermogenes and Sittis nodded vigorously.
But these aren't Balearic slingers, Morris, demurred Antonina. The islanders are famous, have been for centuries. These are just farm boys.
Morris shrugged.
So what? Every one of those peasants, especially the shepherds, have been using a sling since he was a boy. Sure, they're not professionals like the Balearic islanders, but that doesn't matter for our needs. The only real difference between a Balearic mercenary slinger and a peasant lad is accuracy. That matters when you're slinging iron bullets. It doesn't, not much anyway, when you're hurling grenades.
John started to get excited then.
You know, you're right. How far could one of these Syrian boys toss a grenade?
Morris fluttered the stubby fingers of one thick hand.
Depends. Show me the grenade you're talking about, and I'll give you a close answer. Roughly, as far as an average archer with a sling. With a sling staff, as far as a cataphract or a Persian. Cavalry'd make mincemeat out of them, stated Sittis.
Morris nodded.
Alone, yes. Good cavalry, anyway. They didn't panic at the first barrage. They'd rout the grenade slingers. Call them grenadiers, interjected John. Got more dignity.
Grenadiers, then.
He paused, ruminated then.
Grenadiers. I like that.
Hermogenes nodded vigorously.
A special name will give the men morale, the young general stated. I like it, too. In fact, I think it's essential.
Sittis mused.
So we'll need cavalry on the flanks.
Need a solid infantry bulwark, too, interjected Hermogenes.
Morris nodded.
Yes, that too. There's nothing magical about grenades. In the right combination, used the right way.
Hermogenes.
A phalanx, maybe.
Sittis.
Damn nonsense. Phalanxes are as obsolete as eating on a couch. No, no, Hermogenes. It's the old Republican maniples you want to look at. I think...
Bishop Cashin turned to Antonina.
May I suggest we leave these gentlemen to their play, my dear? I predict that within a minute the discussion will be too technical for us to follow anyway, and I'm dying to hear all about your exploits in Constantinople.
Antonina rose, smiling.
Let's repair to the salon, then.
She looked at Michael.
Will you join us?
The monk shook his head.
I suspect that your own discussion with Anthony will soon be as technical as that of these gentlemen, he said ruefully. I'm afraid that I would be of no more use in plotting palace intrigues than I am in calculating military tactics and formations.
Sittis happened to overhear the remark.
What's the matter, Michael?
A teasing grin came to his face.
Surely you're not suggesting that the eternal soul has no place in the mundane world.
The monk gazed on the general like a just-fed eagle gazes on a mouse. Current interest mild.
You and yours, he said softly, will bring to the battle weapons and tactics. Antonina and Anthony and theirs will bring to the battle knowledge of the enemy. But in the end, Sittis, it will come to this. All the gifts you bring will be as nothing, unless the peasant boy to whom you give them has a soul which can face Satan in the storm.
He rose. I will give you that peasant. On his way out, Michael bestowed a considering look upon Sittis, like a just-fed eagle considers a mouse. Future prospects. Excellent.
Always a bad idea, baiting a holy man, murmured Morris.
It's true, he insisted in the face of Sittis's glare. He drained his cup.
Ask any peasant.
The next morning, the two generals accompanied John of Rhodes out to the training field, eager to experiment with the grenades. Morris was waiting for them with a dozen peasant volunteers. The Syrians were quite nervous in the beginning. Even after their prowess at grenade hurling earned them praise of the generals, the young men were abashed in the company of such noble folk.
Soon enough, however, Michael of Macedonia made his appearance. He said nothing, neither to the generals nor to the peasants. But it was amusing to Morris to watch the way in which the monk's presence transformed the Syrian boys into young eaglets in the presence of giant mice. By mid-afternoon, the eaglets were arguing freely with the giant mice. Not over tactics, of course, or military formations, although the Syrians did have some valuable advice on the practical realities of slinging grenades. Most of it concerned the pragmatics of fuses and their length. The young men were not foolish. Uneducated and illiterate, yes. Stupid, no. They did not presume to understand the art of war better than such men as Sidis and Hermogenes, or, especially, they had their own peasant view of such things, Morris. But they had quite strong opinions on the question of barracks and the nature of military camps. Their children would not like barracks, though they would probably enjoy the tent life of camps. Their wives would like neither, but would tolerate the camps. They were simple women, practical. Barracks, however, simply wouldn't do. No privacy. Immodest. Their wives were simple women, but decent. They were not camp followers. They wanted huts. Each family its own hut. A tent, of course, would do for the root camps. The generals explained the absurdity of such an arrangement, violation of military tradition. The peasants explained the absurdity of military tradition. In the end, while a monk watched, smiling, smiling, young peasants disciplined generals. No huts, no grenadiers. In a different way, another clash of wills was taking place in the villa. "It is much too dangerous, Antonina," insisted the bishop. "I thought so last night, and I feel even more strongly about it today." He pushed his plate of food away. "Look," he said accusingly, "I've even lost my appetite." Antonina smiled, studying his rotund form. As modest and plain living as Bishop Cassian undoubtedly was, no one had ever mistaken him for an ascetic, not at least when it came to meals. She shrugged. "It could be, yes. Not for the moment, however. I assure you, Anthony, the last thing the Malwa will do is harm me. I'm their pride and joy, the very apple of their eye." Cassian stared stubbornly at his uneaten lunch. Antonina sighed. "Can't you understand, Anthony? After Ajatasattru trapped me, quite a trap too, but with me being overheard by two deacons crying out for the death of Justinian, they had me in a vice, as they see it. They're squeezing for all it's worth. Before I left Constantinople, they got from me every detail of the Hippodrome faction's internal politics." She broke off for a moment, grimacing. "I still don't know why they're so fascinated by that subject. Mother of God, it's all I ever heard about from my father growing up. This blue did that, and that green did that, and those blues are so many clowns, but keep your eyes out for that set of greens." She threw up her hands with exasperation. "I even had to track down some of my father's old cronies, the ones I could find in Constantinople at any rate, in order to bring my knowledge of the factions up to date. God in heaven, what a sorry lot of ruffians."
"Were they pleased to see you again?" asked Cassian mildly. "After all this time?" Antonina looked startled. Then she grinned quite merrily. "To tell the truth, they fawned all over me. Local girl makes good, comes back to visit the home folks. I hadn't realized how famous Belisarius has become among these circles." She shrugged. "So in the end, I was able to give Balban every detail of the doings of the Hippodrome factions. And I still don't know why the Malwa—"
"I don't think it's so odd, Antonina," interrupted Cassian. "There must be 20 or 30,000 of those bravos in Constantinople. Not an insignificant military force, potentially." Antonina snickered.
"Hippodrome thugs? Be serious, Anthony. Oh, to be sure, they're a rough enough crowd in the streets, but against cataphracts? Besides, they're about evenly divided between the blues and the greens, more likely to whip on each other than do any Malwa bidding."
The bishop rubbed two fingers together in the ancient gesture for coin. Antonina cocked her head quizzically.
"That's Irene's opinion, too, but I think she's overestimating the strength of the factions, even if the Malwa can unite them with bribes."
She shook her head.
"Enough of that. At least now the Malwa are demanding some sensible secrets from me.
By the time I get back to Constantinople a few months from now, I'm to provide them with a detailed breakdown of all the military units in the East. All of them. Not just here in Syria, but in Palestine as well. Even Egypt. She grinned. Or else. Cashin stared at her, still unsmiling. Antonina's grin faded away. It's that or else you're worried about, isn't it? Cashin took a deep breath, exhaled. Actually, no. At least, not much. He rose from the table and began pacing slowly about the dining room. I'm afraid you don't really grasp my fear, Antonina. I agree with you about the Marwa, as it happens. For now, at least, they will do you no harm at all. Antonina frowned. Then what? It was Anthony's turn to throw up his hands with exasperation. Can you possibly be so naive? There are not simply Marwa involved in this plot, woman. There are Romans also. And they have their own axes to grind. Grind against each other's blades, often enough. He stepped to the table, planted his pudgy hands firmly, and leaned over. You have placed yourself in a maelstrom, Antonina. Between Scylla and Charybdis and a multitude of other monsters, all of whom are plotting as much against their conspirators as they are against the Roman Empire. He thrust himself back upright. You have no idea where the blade might come from, my dear. No idea at all. You see only the Malwa, and only the face they turn toward you. Antoninus stared grimly back at him, unyielding. And so? I understand your point, Anthony, but I say again. So? Her shrug was enough to break the bishop's heart. It was not a woman's shrug, but the gesture of a veteran. That's war, Cassian. You do the best you can against the enemy, knowing he fully intends to return the favor. One of you wins, one of you loses. Dies, usually. A thin smile came to her face. Belisarius, Morris too, I think my husband got it from him, has a saying about it. He calls it the first law of battle. Every battle plan gets fucked up, pardon my language, Bishop, as soon as the enemy arrives. That's why he's called the enemy. Cashin stroked his beard. There was weariness in the gesture, but some humor also. Crude, crude, he murmured. Altogether coarse. Refined theologians would express the matter differently. Every sound doctrine gets contradicted as soon as the other dogmatists arrive at the council. That's why they're called heretics. Finally, he smiled. Very well, Antonina. I cannot stop you in any event. I will give you all the assistance which I can. He resumed his seat. Then, after staring at his plate for a moment, pulled it back before him and began eating with his usual gusto. Won't be much when it comes to military matters and hippodrome factions. He waved his knife cheerfully. Church conspirators, on the other hand, and there'll be plenty of them, be sure of it, on a different matter altogether. He speared two dates. Clisirius of Chalcedon and George Barsimes, is it? The dates disappeared as if by magic. He skewered a pair. Rufinus Nemesianus, Bishop of Ravenna, he mumbled thoughtfully, his mouth full of shredding fruit. Know him well. The last piece of pear sped down his throat like a child down the gullet of an ogre. Babes in the woods, he belched. After the generals returned at sundown, Antonina listened to their ranting and raving for half an hour. Tact and diplomacy, she thought, required as much. Then she made her ruling. Of course they won't live in barracks. The idea's absurd. These men aren't conscripts, gentlemen. They're volunteers, established farmers with families. They marry early here and start raising children by the time they're 15. Younger, the girls. The generals gobbled. John of Rhodes began to stump. Antonina examined them curiously. What did you expect? Did you think these men would abandon their families just to be your grenade tossers? Gobbling ceased. Generals stared at each other. A naval officer stumbled in his stumping. Athenina snorted. You didn't think. Snort. Sometimes I agree with Theodora. Men. Sittis leveled his finest glare upon her, the boar in full fury.
You'll not be making any royal decrees here, young woman.
I most certainly will, replied Antonina quite sweetly. I'm the paymaster, remember?
She cocked her head at John of Rhodes.
Are you done with your stumping?
The naval officer pouted.
Antonina reached to the floor, hauled up a sack, clumped it on the table. Hire workmen, John. Better yet, pay the peasants themselves.
The lads are handy with their hands. They'll have the huts up in no time, and they'll be happier for having made their own new homes. From the doorway came Michael's voice.
They'll be wanting a chapel, too. Nothing fancy, of course.
The generals, cowed by the woman, transferred their outrage to the monk. The Macedonian stared back. Like a just-fed eagle stares at chittering mice. Contest of wills. Laughable.